Good morning.
First case this morning is United States v. Mangahus. Is the appellant prepared? Is the government prepared? Appellant may argue.
Good morning, Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court. May it please the court. For the court's situational awareness, I have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes.
17 years is too long. At the motions hearing, the military judge asked the question, or made the statement, it's too long for anyone to remember, especially the accused, what happened back in 1997. And the trial counsel responded, sir, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And I cannot sit here wearing any mantle for the government or otherwise and tell you different. That's at page 105 of the record.
But has the legislature weighed in on that issue through not imposing a statute of limitations?
Your Honor, the statute of limitations is what the courts have called the primary protection. However, going back to Marion, Lovasco, and even this court's opinion in Reed, it's very clear that the due process clause of the Fifth Amendment is a stopgap. It's also available to protect an accused's due process rights when the statute of limitations doesn't adequately protect them.
Do you agree that the statute of limitations that we look to is the one that was in effect at the time of the alleged offense?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you agree with the military judge that Willenbring was correctly decided?
No, Your Honor. I could spend the whole argument talking about statute of limitations. I very respectfully disagree. I think that case was not argued properly. This court was not presented with the appropriate arguments that are presented in our motion to dismiss based on statute of limitations. I think had those arguments been made, this court would have come out differently in Willenbring.
Do you believe that Coker applies in the military context, or that there's any reason that the military back in 1977 had any different interest in the death penalty for a rape case than the civilian world?
No, Your Honor. I think that the considerations are the same, and I should say that the Coker doesn't prevent the death penalty in any rape case. It's only going to prevent it in a case like this where there's no actual or intended death involved with the rape. Yes, ma'am. So with that factual background, I would like to discuss 2 points with the court today that would help the court's disposition of the legal issue, which is whether a due process violation occurred. And those 2 issues, of course, are the egregiousness of the delay and the actual prejudice that resulted from the egregious delay. And our contention with respect, Your Honors, is that the military judge did not abuse his discretion. He properly found a due process violation after considering a ton of evidence and facts, and he very carefully and thoughtfully analyzed the controlling case law and applied it to the facts in this case. So his facts are supported by the record, and his legal conclusions are correct. And it's very important to point out, Your Honors, that the government stipulated to the facts that support the military judge's ruling. If you look at page 26 to 28 of the record, the government is asked multiple times, does everybody agree on the facts for purposes of this motion? The government says, yes, Your Honor. Which makes it important to go back and look at the facts that are
set. Could you speak up just a little?
Yes, Your Honor. Sorry.
Thank you.
In the motion to dismiss, there's a very lengthy recitation of facts. And the judge asks the trial counsel during the motions hearing several times, why aren't there any witnesses here? Do you guys agree on the facts? And both the defense and the government told the judge, yes, Your Honor, we agree on the facts. And so why that's important for Your Honors is that in the motion, if you look at paragraph 7, of the motion to dismiss, which is Appellate Exhibit 10, you will see all of the relevant facts pertinent to the counselor at issue, that the witness who unfortunately has passed away. The government agreed to those facts at the motions hearing, and then several times later during the motions hearing, they concede or they admit to facts that they now on appeal are taking issue with, and we respectfully say they are stuck with what they admitted to at trial.
So what particular facts are you focused on that you feel are damaging to the government?
The fact issue regarding what the counselor said to the complaining witness, it was just not an issue at the trial level. I was there. The parties did not contest what the counselor said to the complaining witness. We all agreed.
So are you getting at the point of whether the counselor said that the victim should go forward with counseling or the victim should go forward with the prosecution.
Precisely.
That distinction is what
Yes, Your Honor. And it just, it was a distinction without a difference at trial. And all of a sudden on appeal, it becomes an issue when the lower courts found and that the judge's finding was not supported by the record. And with all due respect, it's the appellate court's finding that's clearly erroneous because the government admitted to those facts at trial. And not only did the military judge who heard the motions in this case find that the complaining witness's contention would be that the counselor told her both things, don't continue counseling and don't continue with the case. But the preliminary hearing officer, who himself also was a military judge, found the exact same thing. In fact, in our motion, again in paragraph 7 of Appellate Exhibit 10, if you look, we cite as authority for those propositions the testimony at the 32 and the preliminary hearing officer's conclusion that that's what the testimony would be.
So is it your position that if the government did not object to the military judge saying, do you agree with these facts, that the CCA cannot say, we've looked at the record, and the record does not support that conclusion?
I think as a matter of principle, the court can do that, Your Honor, but I think they were wrong when they did it in this case because the record was full of evidence that supported the judge's finding. So I think that if the judge makes some sort of finding that's not supported by the record, then the appellate court, the CCA, certainly can find it clearly erroneous. My suggestion, Your Honor, is that the CCA was wrong when it did it in this case because all of the judge's findings regarding that issue were supported by the record. So, again...
So what refresh my memory, what is our scope of review
under the
posture we're in right now?
Yes, Your Honor. This court is to review the military judge's findings and conclusions and dismissal. This court will review what the military judge did for an abuse of discretion. But because the due process violation is a question of law, there's a de novo review of that. So it's a little confusing that I think this court must decide itself whether there was a due process violation. And if so, then clearly the military judge did not abuse his discretion because he so found. And that's what we're asking the court to do. We're asking you to find that a due process violation occurred because there was an egregious delay in this case. And that delay caused actual prejudice to the trial of this case. And we're asking you to reverse the lower court and affirm the military judge's dismissal of the case with prejudice.
Can you focus specifically, please, on that issue of prejudice?
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. As a prelude to that, it's really important to note that despite both written and verbal reports of rape to Coast Guard officials, government officials, including law enforcement, there was no investigation, there was no evidence preservation, there was not even any notice to the person accused. And so
I don't think the government contests any of that. How does that go to prejudice?
It goes to prejudice, Your Honor, because Colonel Mangahus was not on notice for the last 20 years or 17 years by the time he got notice that there was any accusation out there. So he was not in a position to preserve evidence, and the government didn't preserve it. And so now that evidence is gone 20 years later. And I have
so are you now untethering from your argument this issue of PM, the therapist, from your overarching theme of it's just not fair because of the length of time that has passed?
They're two separate issues. They're related, right? So my contention is the egregiousness in this case has both qualitative and quantitative components. The quantitative component is just the mere length of the delay, 17 years. Who can remember what they were doing 17 years ago? But qualitatively, you have to look at what was the government doing during those 17 years. If they were actively investigating and talking to witnesses and taking photos and taking witness statements, that'd be one thing. But they concede. They literally did nothing. The military judge specifically asked trial counsel, what has the government done between 1998 and 2014? And trial counsel had no choice but to say nothing.
Counsel, when was the government first apprised of this allegation?
According to the complaining witness, she made both verbal and written reports in 1997. And it's really important. There were multiple people named by name. When she writes this statement, which I can't help myself, just point out they're undated, unsigned, and unsworn, but for purposes of this motion, they're statements of the complaining witness that she submitted to Coast Guard officials in 1997. And they say, I told this person, I told this person, I told her company commander, legal, her friend. Not a single person was even asked the question, did this happen? What did she say to you? Not one person was interviewed. Then in 98.
The state of the record, just because, as I'm sure you're aware, if the complaining witness didn't bring this forward until, if the reason it didn't go forward was until, she can't violate the due process clause, right?
Exactly, Your Honor. Right, Our contention is it's the government's inaction. The reason why we're here is that the
due. But I'm just asking, the state of the record then is that she alleges that she complained to multiple people 20 years ago.
Yes, Your Honor, and we do
have. There's no evidence other than her saying that and these pieces. If the government says we didn't do anything because, what did they say?
They're saying they didn't do any. Now on appeal, well, first of all, let me back up. At the time, there's no memo to the file. There's no record made of we're not doing anything because the complaining witness doesn't want us to, which my contention is that wouldn't have made any difference. The complaining witness can say I don't want to participate, but she can't tell the government don't investigate my case. The government had a duty, an obligation, and the means to conduct an investigation that would preserve evidence for this very, to prevent where we are today, that God forbid, years later, she changed her mind and decided she did want to go forward. At least the government would have at its disposal evidence to use, and the defense would as well. So the due process.
What evidence are you talking about that the government would have preserved? She didn't immediately report this, did she?
She claims that she reported it to her friend the next morning after the rape.
But in terms of to law enforcement or anyone, there was a delay. So I'm asking what evidence would have been preserved.
Your Honor, that's a really important point in this case. She claims she reported it 3 months after it happened. So at that time, she was a junior. She was a second class at the Coast Guard Academy. So all of those classmates who, for example, lived on her hall and would have been eyewitnesses to whether they saw the visit or not, or heard her say anything, or who heard any disclosures by her. All those people were readily available and could have been interviewed, and their testimony or the substance of what they knew preserved for future use.
So you're not speaking about preservation of physical evidence.
That was what I was getting to next, physical evidence. For example, she talks in her written statement that she said she made in 97 about forensic evidence that might exist in the room, ejaculation.
3 months later?
I'm not a scientist, Your Honor, but I'm sure that even if she washed her bedding, you see it all the time on the news. My husband makes me watch forensic files all the time. They're always finding hair and fiber and DNA years after these murders and these heinous crimes. So 3 months later, I think at least it was worth a look. I think the government, when a young female cadet tells the government, I was raped in my dorm room, I think they have an obligation to try to find what evidence is there.
But part of what we have to wrestle with here is the issue of speculation. It seems to me that you're piling on speculation here in terms of what might have been different if this had moved forward at that time.
Your Honor, I will agree with you that I don't know whether the DNA was still on the floor or the bed or on the doorknob. I don't know with certainty. But there's a good faith basis to believe there would be some forensic evidence when a man comes into a woman's room, gets on top of her, rapes her, ejaculates in the room, not in her body. I think that's far from pure speculation.
In terms of the testimony of PM, the counselor, it's a little bit unclear what she might have testified to. She did not make any contemporaneous notes, memo to file, nothing like that came up. We simply have the assertion of Captain Diaz, who says, well, she was in the vanguard of those who were supporting students, therefore she would not have counseled her, the victim, to not go forward with the case. Isn't there, though, an overlay here of privilege, where how do we know that she even would have, the counselor, would have been able to testify at the trial if she had been alive? And if we don't know that, how would we find prejudice?
Well, I think, Your Honor, had this been investigated in a timely manner and gone to trial, or even if we were to go to trial now and the counselor were alive, once the complaining witness gets on the stand and says, I told the counselor I was raped and she told me not to do anything about it, don't get counseling, don't go forward, I think that waives the
But
privilege.
How do we know at this point that that's what the victim would have testified to? And so it gets to the point of, are we premature in this process?
No, Your
Honor. If you're familiar with United States versus Crouch, Fifth Circuit says these types of cases, they need to go to trial to develop the facts so we can point to things that are not as speculative about how this case would have rolled out differently if it had happened much sooner. So what's your reaction to the Fifth Circuit in U.S. versus Kraft?
I have not read that case, Your Honor, but my reaction is that we have a good faith basis to believe, based on the written statements and the oral statement that the complaining witnesses made at the time and in 2014, that was her contention, is I wanted to go forward, but these people in the position of authority convinced me not to. And I think that would be an issue at trial, because those statements of what she said happened to her and what she was told in response would be prior statements that could and should have been used to either support her testimony or impeach it. And that's the prejudice, Your Honor. We can't impeach her now with this nebulous, you know, I don't think that the SJA's testimony is speculation.
You asked the military judge to craft a rule that she can't say that.
About the counselor?
That she can't use that as the reason for why she didn't report it.
Didn't think of it, Your Honor. But you have her also related, you have her statements to the SJA and the deputy SJA that are along the same lines. So if we precluded her from testifying to all of those things, I certainly think it would change the complexion of the case, but I don't think it diminishes the actual prejudice that we've suffered. Because, I mean, and again, I know you might say this is speculation. I don't think it is. I think we have a good faith. And it was more than just the SJA's opinion of because she was a counselor. It was his interaction with her, his observations of her, his discussions with her that gave him the factual basis to give his opinion that this is not something she would do. The counselor would not discourage a cadet from either proceeding with counseling or pursuing a case.
Counsel, your time has expired.
Oh, thank you, Your Honor. May I finish answering the question?
Yes, you may.
The SJA's, thank you, Your Honor. The SJA's testimony is not speculation, right? It's based on facts that are now in the record due to his testimony. And those facts now are fair game for the military judge to rely on when he made a finding that there was actual prejudice, that this is a consent case, and the complaining witness's credibility is the only issue in the case. And therefore, what she said to whom and what she said and who she said it to are very important issues for this case, and for Colonel Manga has to be able to defend himself at trial. Thank you.
Thank you. We will hear from the government.
Chief Judge, judges of the court, may it please the court. I am Major Matt Osborne, and I, along with Colonel Catherine Oler, represent the United States in this matter. The Air Force Court correctly found that the military judge abused his discretion by finding that the appellant faced actual prejudice, did not. Well, let me rephrase that a little bit.
Say again.
That's a good start. This is going to go well. It's got 19 and a half minutes to go.
Yeah.
The Air Force Court correctly found that the military judge abused his discretion when the military judge found that the appellant faced actual prejudice as a result of the delay in this case. The appellant has failed to show the Air Force Court erred in making that finding and failed to show actual prejudice in this case. And as such, this court should affirm the Air Force Court's opinion and return this case for trial to Hill Air Force Base.
So now, what's the statute of limitations here?
The statute is none, Your Honor.
So 60 years later, can walk in and there's no due process violation concerns, sense of fairness of going forward when the record reflects that if you look at it the way that the defense does, that she has raised this flag to others in the command and elsewhere 20 years ago. We should not have any concerns 60 years later if something like this happens?
Well, Your Honor, I think what Marion and Levesque told us is that we can't have a bright line rule when we're looking at due process violations for pretrial delay. And in fact, Levesque said, you know, pretrial due process, Fifth Amendment, should be used in, you know, for very small circumstances
usually, for most offenses, you don't have to worry so much about a delay of this length, because usually we're not dealing with a statute of limitations of forever. Right?
Correct, Your Honor.
So, I mean, well, let me ask you this. Would you agree that a delay of 17 years is egregious?
In this case, no, Your Honor.
Why not?
What? I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Why not?
Well, because if we go back to the facts of this case and look at the record of this case, What the record shows is that we had a victim that 17 years ago, when she came forward and reported this, did not want to go forward with an investigation, did not want to go forward with a report. And in fact, when she talked to the counselor about, and the counselor, according to Ms. Diaz, says, you know, I don't recommend you going forward with counseling, it was in the vein of all the repercussions of what this report and what this investigation could entail, which was, you know, career repercussions.
Okay, so, egregious means, you know, that it's a long time, right? And that it's a really long time. And sort of like some of the reasons that you're saying is you think that it makes it less egregious that someone decided 17, 20 years ago that they didn't want to do something and then said they changed their mind 17 years later.
Well, I think
does the motive for why they changed their mind have anything to do with the case?
Well, I think the motive is something that should be fleshed out at trial. And I also think the motive piece kind of goes to the ability for the appellant in this case to not be able to show actual prejudice, because that motive is certainly going to be there. And in fact, the motive of why she came forward 20 years ago would not have been a motive to impeach her 20 years ago if she'd have gone forward then. So that is a thing that actually helps the appellant's case, not hurts it. So that goes against his actual prejudice. But with the cases,
what is the accused supposed to do? Regardless of what happened in 1997, back in the Clinton administration, back in the days of Monica Lewinsky and all that stuff, and here's the accused, and suddenly, boing, this thing pops up 17 years later. Isn't the mere passage of time egregiously prejudicial? People die. People forget. People change their minds, especially in a he said, she said, and that's it situation.
I think the mere passage of time is not enough if you look at the cases. But again, in this case, you look at what the...
How much time is enough time?
It's a case-by-case basis.
Right, and what makes 17 years not enough here?
And that goes to the actual prejudice in this case. And that test is...
What makes 17 years not enough here?
Okay. Well, in this case, we can look to see about the appellant's ability to mount an effective defense, which is the test for...
Dead witness.
Prejudice. What's that, Your Honor?
Dead witness.
Well, in that case, first off, we go back to the assumptions of that it's speculative of what she was going to testify to, if she even could testify to. It's also speculative as well.
No, but the point is she could testify to something. It is speculation, but you're the government. The witness is dead. How is that not essentially intrinsically prejudicial?
Well, I think we look at to see what the witness would have testified
to. But you've already said that's speculation.
Whose responsibility was it to interview the witness and make sure that whatever she was going to testify was committed to an interview notes, or to preserve or to obtain notes from counseling sessions, or to do something?
And again,
I'm just asking, whose responsibility is that?
That would have been the government's at that time.
Okay. And if, as the alleged victim says, she came forward 17 years ago, 3 months after this happened, and said that all this happened, whose responsibility was it at that time to investigate and open an investigation and commit that investigation to paper?
Well, I think the responsibility is at that time was... and certainly in the eyes of the SJA, the 06 there that was at the Coast Guard Academy, was whether or not he had a case to go forward with. And what we had here, when he was looking at this case, at that point it was 1 year later, and there was no physical evidence. He recognized it was a he said, she said case. And what he had was a victim who did not want to go forward, according to the statement she made at that time, according to the testimony that we have from the 06 at that time. So his case was, I don't have a case, and I don't have any physical evidence at this point because it's 1 year later, and that's that.
So the government has an excuse. But that doesn't throw the burden on the accused. It's not the accused's burden to go out and snake around and get all this stuff in the hope that, you know, this won't blow up 17 years later. The government chose to do nothing. And now the government, it seems to me, is stuck with the consequences of doing nothing.
Well, but it is on the defendant, it is on the accused in this case, according to case law, to show actual prejudice. And in that is his
ability. Okay, the government did nothing. The government did nothing. The witness is dead. Other memories fade. Now I ask you again, how does that not amount to actual prejudice?
Well, let's talk about Ms. PM first. So first we have the issue of whether or not DS ever said what the defense is now saying Ms. DS said about Ms. PM. And that is, she...
The judge evidently thought so.
Well, and we have maintained throughout that the judge is incorrect.
Okay, but the judge thought so.
Correct.
Right, but and that's a finding of fact by the judge.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's a finding of fact that goes against the record because it goes against the testimony of the Coast Guard SJA who said, I didn't discourage her, and it also goes against the statements of the victim back both in 1998 as well as in 2014 when she said, look, I didn't want to go forward then. I didn't want a report. I didn't want an investigation. And then in 2014, she says, she recommended I don't go forward with counseling. Nothing about the rape allegation. But even if we
Now, that's a curious point. If one goes forward with prosecution and doesn't go forward with counseling, isn't that sort of intrinsically contradictory?
Now?
No, then.
Not necessarily, because I think there's...
This gets weirder and weirder.
Right, and it also gets more and more into speculation.
Doesn't the record...
But who's doing the speculating?
Doesn't the record support, though, that the rationale for not going forward in those days was she wanted to graduate from the academy. She didn't want to get hung up in this mess, or whatever you want to call it.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So that was... So nothing was done. You agree with that? No forensic investigation, no statement from other witnesses or any of that was done?
Yes, sir.
I had Judge Olson ask you about the statute of limitations for rape. Congress also put the death penalty on for rape, but that was knocked out for due process concerns. Why should the statute of limitations be unlimited in a modern society for rape, for adults?
Well, I mean, because as it is on the books, and certainly as it was in 1997, there was no statute.
I think this, do you agree with appellant's counsel that the version of Article 43 that we're looking at is the one that was in effect in 1997? Okay, and do you agree that do you believe that there's a military reason that would make Coker inapplicable in the military context, meaning that death would be an available punishment for rape?
That it would be? Mm-hmm. Yes, Your Honor. And I would also...
So what about the Supreme Court's decision in Coker would not apply in the military context? What would make the military different so that there's a unique military interest in having the death penalty available in 1997 for rape?
Well,
when the Supreme Court said in 1977 that it was not available for civilian jurisdictions.
Your Honor, all I can say to that is that was the face of the law at that time. And I would also say...
I'm asking you a different question, which is give me a military reason in 1997 that the Supreme Court's decision in Coker wouldn't have precluded someone from being punished by death or rape of an adult that did not result in any injury.
I apologize, Your Honor. I can't give you an answer to that. And the reason is, one, that was not an issue, but looked too much into, because the military judge at trial, there was a motion to dismiss for the statute of limitations, and the military judge there found that there was no statute of limitations, and that applied to this case.
Right. And he did that based on Wilmbring, right, which decided what it decided, but I'm not bound to accept that, am I?
I understand that, Your Honor. I was just pointing that piece out.
Would we distinguish this case from the cases we all read about where priests are prosecuted for abuse of children 30 years prior to the prosecution, or whether the famous comedian Bill Cosby is charged for offenses he allegedly committed a long time ago that were not reported at the time, that kind of thing? Is there any way to distinguish this case from those?
I don't believe there is.
Isn't one distinguished that the authorities did not know about the events at the time?
Well,
and when it came to light, then the investigation ensued, blah, blah, blah. Here we have the contrary facts. The authorities did know about it and elected to do nothing.
Well, but there's also other cases in our original Air Force Court Article 62. We cited a few of those from multiple federal circuits, and in fact, a state case from Ohio that the military judge cited in his ruling. That Ohio state case was an 18-year delay from allegations of rape, and that case actually involved the loss of the physical evidence that was taken at the time. And even in that case, they found that there wasn't any actual prejudice. There are other cases.
Okay, so you're reaching out to a single state case there. But here, you kind of talk about the fact that, well, she didn't want to go forward. But we all know the government prosecutes in the name of the sovereign, not in the name of the accused. Even if it's a he said, she said case, even if the accuser does not want to go forward, that didn't freeze the government. The government could have continued to look for evidence, importantly could have spoken to witnesses, could have committed their statements to writing, could have put in the file the fact that the victim is stating that she does not wish to go forward with the case. Instead, we've got the government knowing about the case and then just washing its hands of it and turning away from the case for 17 years. Why shouldn't we say, government, you handled this poorly. It's on you.
But again, in that case, I think that goes to the delay prong, not the prejudice prong. But to the delay piece, again, at the time, we had, you know, the prosecutor, or, you know, the SJA, who, again, in Lovasco, the Supreme Court said should have some certainly deference to making those decisions, who had a he said, she said case. He had a victim who did not want to go forward, and he had an allegation that was 1 year old, that at that point it were 1 year old and had no physical evidence. So, you know,
he reported it to other people that, you know, were part of the government before then, right?
Well, according to her, she did. Now, according to...
Well, you can't have it both ways. She's either telling the truth or she's not.
Well, and I understand that, Your Honor. But
because, I mean, I think I would hope that you would at least agree that we'd be in a better position if the SJA would have at least sought to interview the accused, right? The
Absolutely.
Appellant?
Sure.
Right, but he didn't even do that?
Well, so when victim says this, she initially reported that. She says she initially reported it to a Lieutenant GS, who was the second person in the legal office to the captain of the 06 SJA. Now, interestingly, the military judge doesn't mention this Lieutenant GS anywhere in his ruling. The Lieutenant GS is not part of the Article 32, not part of any of this stuff. So certainly, if we wanted to get to what was told to the victim, who discouraged what or whatever, Lieutenant GS is still there. And that is what goes to my bigger point of the appellant still has the ability to mount an effective defense. And that is the test for actual prejudice. So here, you know, with Ms. PM, even if we were to assume, all right, she did, quote unquote, discourage DS from going forward back then, which, again, we don't know if that is actually the case. For all we know, Ms. PM could have gotten on the stand and said, you know what, I did discourage her in 1998, because I was concerned about how victims were being treated, and I knew it would impact her career, and so I did discourage her. Well, if that was Ms. DS, if that's PM's testimony, then that actually helps DS's credibility and hurts the appellant's case, because it hurts the appellant's ability to impeach the victim as to why she came forward in 2014.
It's interesting that you're arguing that the delay is fundamentally excusable because in 1997 they thought the case wasn't worth pursuing. 17 years later, with everything that's happened, suddenly the case is worth pursuing.
Well, and, Your Honor, I would say the one thing that has changed
between... is politics.
But, no, Your Honor. The thing that has changed between 1998 and 2014 is a victim in a he-said-she-said case who is now ready to go forward. If you look at the SJA's testimony...
And it was... What was the recommendation as to whether the case should go forward?
The pretrial hearing officer recommended it not go forward, Your Honor. But if you look...
And what did the military judge find? That there was a constitutional violation and it shouldn't go forward?
He found the Fifth Amendment part, not the evidence itself, but the delay was why it should not go forward. But to your honor, your point about in 1998, they thought they essentially had a loser case. If you look at the 06's testimony from the Article 32, he said he thought there was something there, but because the victim in a he said she said case with no physical evidence didn't want to go forward, he said nothing I could do. And then
isn't one of the reasons that, well, the record seems to indicate that one of the reasons that the SJA didn't go forward is he was concerned about the jurisdictional issue, was he not? Well, in fact, at the time, the accused had already been disenrolled from the Coast Guard Academy, had he not?
Well, Your Honor, he did say there was a jurisdictional issue that was there, but he said that he would have been more than happy to look into that had he had a victim who was wanting to go forward.
I thought the finding was that, and I could be wrong, and excuse me if I am, but I thought the finding was that he thought it was too hard.
Well, that was a paraphrasing from the military judge as to what the SJA said. Now, what the SJA said is that it was a difficult jurisdiction issue. One, at the dorms, there was some concurrent jurisdiction things at that point, but also by the time this was brought back up, the appellant was now gone from the Coast Guard and was now actually in Air Force OTS. So he doesn't say it was, quote, too hard to do. He said it was difficult, but he also said he would do that, except he didn't have a victim who wanted to go forward.
Right, but going forward for prosecution is different than going forward to investigate and preserve evidence, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
And was he making both of those determinations?
Well, he was making the determination about whether or not he had a case that could be prosecuted at that time.
But if nothing new has changed, would he still say he has a case?
Well, now I would believe he would definitely say he has one because he has a victim who is willing to go forward. Yeah. And, Your Honor, I see my time is almost up. If I could just very briefly conclude. The appellant here has not lost the ability to mount an effective defense. If you look at what he was able to show at the Article 32 with the 22 declarations he was given, if you look at the declaration that he got from the friend who the victim says she told the day after, this victim now says, I don't remember that. That helps the accused. There is no physical evidence, and there would never have been any physical evidence in 1998 as well. So none of that is at issue. What is at issue is whether or not he has the ability to mount an effective defense. And even the judge laid out, the multiple motives, the multiple avenues of attack that the appellant still had to mount an effective defense. And Judge Ryan, as you mentioned, the pretrial hearing officer at the Article 32 found there was no probable cause to go forward. One would say that is at least certainly has the ability to mount an effective defense in that case. So in closing, Your Honor, what happened here is we had a judge who did not like the fact that the statute of limitations, that there wasn't one in this case, and in effect made a de facto statute of limitations because he felt that 17 years was too long, even though state cases, federal cases, have shown that there are cases longer.
I think that's a rather disrespectful analysis of the military judge's ruling.
I agree with Judge Ryan.
He took about 18 or 19 pages to say all that, didn't he?
I mean, that's just inappropriate, counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. Does the accused have rebuttal?
Counsel, before you start, in response to the Chief Judge's line of questioning, if we looked at a timeline, starting with, let's say, 6 months after the complaint to the 17 years, where does the prejudice kick in along that timeline?
It kicks in probably when the opportunity to have easy access to the witnesses who were at the Coast Guard Academy at that time when they graduated and went off to the Four Seas, but maybe even could be extended to when they left active duty, because we all know you could type their name in the global and find them even after they graduate. When the opportunity to find the physical evidence in her room was gone, I mean, I think the prejudice starts to kick in pretty soon after the allegation. Something that's really important to emphasize is, in addition to the SJA and the company officer and the deputy SJA and the counselor, who the most important person the disclosure was made to was CGIS. That's law enforcement. That's their job to investigate. So I think that's where we need to focus our attention on the prejudice, is that law enforcement knew about this allegation. They did nothing about it. And they knew that before the SJA knew about it.
But your answer then raises the flip side, the mirror image of the issue I raised for the government, talking about, well, 60 years out too long. You make it sound as if 6 months later there's been prejudice to the extent that there's a due process violation if the government hasn't gone forward with charges.
But, Your Honor, it's a calculus that takes into account a lot of factors, including the egregiousness of the delay. I would think that if they were continuously investigating, then there would be no egregious delay because the government would be doing something. The Due Process Clause gives citizens the right to have the government proceed diligently in a situation like this, and that's where the government failed in this case. So if the government is doing what it's supposed to do, then you're not going to find an egregious delay, even if there's some level of prejudice. So you don't find a due process violation unless you have the egregious delay and the prejudice, if that answers your question, Your Honor.
Well, I guess the other answer to my question might be that the trial judge is in the best position to judge that. He sees the witnesses, he listens to the explanations and all that, and has a feel,
right,
and makes a ruling. And now we're sitting here second-guessing him, or somebody is.
That's exactly the point, Your Honor. The CCA was just, with all due respect, was just wrong. Because in the government talks about how they've contested this business about, I know this is a big issue about whether she was dissuaded from counseling or from going forward. Our first position is, makes no difference. As you said, Chief Judge Stuckey, they're one and the same thing. And it was not an issue at trial, that this dichotomy that's been created on appeal is just a false dichotomy. At trial, they were the same thing. And I would point the court's attention to the record, page 77 and page 99. Page 77, the government says on the record that, page 99, that the government agrees that the witness said that the counselor pressured her not to go forward, but to go forward with the case. Again, they agree with the statement of facts and the motion. And then even on appeal, if you look at the government's brief that they submitted to the lower court, that's what page 77 is. If you look at page 77 of the government's brief at the lower court, it says this: as the military judge correctly noted, DS claimed Ms. Moulton told her not to pursue the rape case. Not counsel. This all of a sudden at AFSCA, this dichotomy arises. And
they let you file 77-page briefs?
There's no word limit or page limit in the Air Force Court, Your Honor, thank goodness, because I talk like I write, which is too much. But if I may briefly get to prejudice. A big component of prejudice in this case I can't emphasize enough is that Lieutenant Colonel Mangahas was not put on notice. He might have had an alibi, and I would like to read just briefly from in the Marion case, in the concurring opinion from Justice Douglas, Brennan, and Marshall. They cite an 1844 case where they say it is monstrous to put a man on his trial after such a lapse of time. And by the way, they're talking about 2 years. It is monstrous to put a man on his trial after such a lapse of time. How can he account for his conduct so far back? If you accuse a man of a crime the next day, he may be unable to bring forward his servants and family to say where he was and what he was about at the time. But if the charge not be preferred for a year or more, how can he clear himself? No man's life would be safe if such a prosecution were permitted. It would be very unjust to put him in this trial. And that's what happened here, Your Honors. If he had been told in 1997 or 1998, hey, this woman has made this claim against you, he could have said, I wasn't there on Saturday. Every Saturday night I was at my sponsor's house. And he could have got his sponsor to write a statement. And even if the prosecution didn't go forward, at least the evidence was preserved. That's the prejudice.
So your point is this is a bolt out of the blue.
Absolutely. After this man has a stellar career, he is a combat veteran, he's given more than half of his adult life to service of the Air Force, and it's not fair to make him sit at a trial about something that happened 20 years ago when the government chose 20 years ago not to even take the time to talk to a single witness. And, oh, by the way,
Ms. Zimmerman, I know you're in a role here. I don't mind that. But what I wanted to know is whether or not in your research you had come across a case where the government knew about the offense, took little to no action, and 20 years later they brought the case. Did you come upon such a case?
Not a single case, Your Honor. And I won't profess to be the best researcher in the world, but I've read hundreds of cases. And every case where they don't find a due process violation, it's because the accused or the appellant doesn't even proffer any evidence to show what evidence was lost or how it would help him. We've done both in this case. And Pam Moulton was named by name in 97 and in 98 and in 2014, and CGIS knew about her. They didn't bother to talk to her back in the 90s, but they did talk to her for two, and the government concedes this. They talked to her for 2 hours in 2014, did not ask her a single question about this case. So the government wants to say we're blaming her death on the government. I don't blame her death on the government. What I blame the government for is letting her die without anyone asking her the questions that should have been asked to her, that it was their obligation, their duty to do, and they didn't do it. My time is almost out.
Your time is way over.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Your time is way over, and as far as I'm concerned, as far as I know, no one's blaming her death on the government. I mean, that's kind of a curious observation. Your time is up.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks, counsel, for both sides. The case is now submitted, and the court is in recess until 10:30.
All rise. Court stands in recess until 10:30.